Thanks everyone for joining us for Plenary 4, which is, we're talking about operational risk, value and resilience in a world of disruptive change. We've all heard said, or we've possibly thought it ourselves, and I'm not afraid to call it out. Operational risk doesn't always get a seat at the table. Sometimes in banks, it can play second fiddle to credit risk management, and in life companies, it can be sitting in the back seat for insurance risk. There are people who will tell you that, you know, operational risk is really just a cost centre that concerns itself with, you know, the hocus pocus of heat maps and Basel event categories, but it doesn't really add to strategic planning, or it doesn't seem to add value. Perhaps that operational risk just, you know, serves a regulatory purpose. Yet, if you look at the newspapers this year, we are faced with huge geopolitical risks and scary pandemics and cybercrime that could, you know, read more like a Hollywood script, except that it's real. Obviously, there's no argument that operational risk has quite a clear role to play in mitigating for the organisation this type of disruption. But why stop there? What about if, by accepting that if the risks that your competitors face are fairly similar to yours, if you can mitigate a certain risk better than everyone else, surely this can be a competitive advantage. So more than just waiting for disruption to happen, you're actually adding some value. Or what if you have a capital model that's actually quite responsive, and if you have legitimately reduced a risk, then you can free up more capital to help the business. Again, adding some value. And then taking that step even further, what if operational risk and the methodologies we have in operational risk is used in strategic planning in such a sense that the business can, rather than passively wait for disruption, cause some disruption to happen? Once again, adding some value. And if you look at operational risk in this light, it's no longer taking a back seat. Now, to walk through these concepts today, I've got quite an impressive panel. First up, we have Heather Navid, who's the Director for Innovation and Disruption at TAL, followed by Tara Cahill, who's the Chief Risk Officer for Group Services at Westpac. And finally, we'll be hearing from Kieran McKenna, who's the Chief Risk Officer at Cuscal. Just some housekeeping as before. Please fill in your presenter feedback forms. Obviously, mobile phones on silent. We're keen to hear your questions, so SMS your questions to 0417 125 300. And if you'd like to tweet, it's hashtag 2014ERN. So just to introduce Heather. Heather is the Program Director for Innovation and Disruption at TAL, where her role includes the design, implementation, launch and evaluation of pilot programs to test new-to-market propositions. And actually, by background, she has 13 years' experience across life insurance and wealth management industries in both Australia and the UK. She's held roles in capital management, valuation, strategy, pensions, project management, working for Resolution Limited, AMP, CommInsure, prior to joining at TAL. She's also recently completed postgraduate studies in neuroleadership. Let's hear from Heather.
Thank you. Thanks, Blair. Probably want to preface by saying I don't really know that much about operational risk. I really kind of locked onto the disruptive change part of this title. So I'll be chatting a lot more about disruptive change and leaving it to my much more experienced colleagues to talk about the operational risk element of that. So I probably should start by defining what I mean by disruptive change, or what it means to me. So this is really where a new product or service is introduced which really changes the face of the market. It's often something that people didn't ask for, they didn't even know they wanted, but when it arrives, it becomes the new status quo, the thing that we all can't live without. This may well lead to the size of the market growing considerably, and the company that implemented that disruptive product or service will enjoy a disproportionate share of this new market. So if you think about the introduction of mobile phones, so we shifted from having one phone per household to all of us having one, two or more phones, mobile phones that never leave our side. And 15 to 20 years ago, when mobile phones were still quite new, none of us expected to be able to listen to music, do our online shopping, organise our social life, check the weather, find our way from A to B on our phones. We were just kind of grateful if they fit in our pocket and we could get rid of that annoying Nokia ringtone. But the introduction of smartphones completely changed the face of mobile phones and the way we interacted with that world. I want to move on to a few examples of some older and more recent disruptive innovations. So the first three should be pretty damn familiar to everybody. The World Wide Web, it was founded in 1989, and since then it's fundamentally changed the way we connect with people, the way we work, the way we learn, the way we entertain ourselves, and how we view the world. Digital cameras, everyone knows the Kodak story. They invented them in 1975, but they didn't actually become the household commodity until the mid-90s, and really they made the old analog cameras completely redundant from that point. Smartphones, we just touched on. These were actually pretty big in Japan from 1999, but they didn't really come into the mainstream for the rest of us until 2007, when Apple sort of unveiled the first iPhone. And now there are over a billion smartphones in use in the world. So moving on to some of the more recent innovations, which are busy kind of really disrupting the market at the moment. They're the ones grabbing market share. So Uber, this is a ride-sharing service. It was first launched in San Francisco just over 4 years ago, and that's really busy disrupting the taxi industry globally. It offers cheaper, more comfortable service and allows users to actually rate their drivers and drivers to actually rate their users. Currently, Uber is available in 45 countries, in more than 200 cities, and in August, it was actually valued at $18.2 billion, which is pretty amazing. Airbnb allows people who have spare space, either a spare room or they're vacating their house for a weekend or a week or whatever, to actually rent that space out to other people as a cheap alternative to hotel rooms that also allows you to kind of live like a local, get some unique experience in a different city. That also began in San Francisco. That was in 2008, and they've now got millions of users. They operate in 190 different countries, 34,000 cities, and they've actually got more rooms on offer than the entire Hilton chain globally. And finally, Zopa. I don't know if people are familiar with that. Founded in the UK in 2005, that offers a peer-to-peer lending service. So what they do is bring together lenders and borrowers to get them a better value alternative to the traditional banks. To date, they've brought together more than £700 million worth of lending. And they let people lend anything from £10 to £1 million. And what they actually do is a different credit rating for people. So it's not what the traditional banks use. It's actually, what is your Uber score? What's your eBay score? How reliable have you proven yourself to be on other forms of this kind of collaborative social media? And that forms a big part of your credit score. And amazingly, their bad debt ratio is a fraction of what the banks are experiencing. Some of that to do with the scoring, and some of it is because I'm borrowing money from a real person and I can see what they look like. I'm not, you know, it's not a faceless corporation that I don't care about. So as we can see, life can be pretty rosy if you're on the winning side of a disruptive innovation, but a little bit less so for those people that get left behind. So how do you develop resilience in a world of disruptive change? How do we protect ourselves from being disrupted out of the market? And if, as with Kodak, the disruptive brilliance comes from within, how can we guide our company through this disruptive innovation, which might fundamentally challenge the core products or services that have made your company really successful up until now? So these are really the two questions that I want to address over the next few minutes. So let's start with how can we protect ourselves from being disrupted out of the market? So there's three key steps that I want to look at here. Firstly, have a strong radar. Keep a close eye on what everybody else is doing globally. Get to know your customers. Do in-depth research and understand exactly how they're changing and what they're thinking. And finally, try stuff yourself. You know, explore a wide range of ideas and be willing to adapt your basic risk management practices to accommodate this. So what is on the radar for disruption in the life insurance industry? Did you know that there's a peer-to-peer insurer in Germany with over 100,000 members that's currently advertising on TV and growing massively every day? Or a company in the UK that brings together groups of bad risks to negotiate a better rate on a range of insurance products that might not otherwise be available to these people? So a couple of my favourites, I mean, there's pug dog insurance, there's Labrador insurance, there's travel insurance for people with diabetics. It's very niche and they're bringing together and allowing these people access to products and taking the acquisition burden away from the manufacturing company. Now, when I prepared this about 3 weeks ago, they were on 40,198 members. That's now over 46,000 just in that period, so they're growing hugely. Getting to know your customers. You know, with this one, you've really got to conduct the ethnographic research to spot societal and cultural changes. Go into your customers' homes, talk to them, find out how they're changing. Don't just wait until the behaviour becomes evident in your sales, lapse and claims experience, because you'll have missed the boat by then. Our experience has been that half of the market kind of really do want insurance, but they can't find a route to purchase that suits them, and the other half just aren't interested. And we had this, we went into a couple's home and we were interviewing them, and the wife really wanted insurance. She felt that there was a value for them as a household to having it. And the husband, sitting there with his hand all bandaged up, injured yet again from a work-related accident, unable to work, was telling us why insurance just wasn't for them. The big disruptions are coming our way in terms of medical advancements and with the growing popularity of the genomic testing and Fitbit technology. So our customers are going to start demanding to be underwritten in a different way, just like the Zopa customers want to have their credit score rated in a different way. And we need to be ready for that. Finally, try stuff yourself. So the key here is to explore a broad portfolio of ideas and test them quickly and cheaply and be willing to shelve or discard the ones that aren't resonating with your customers. Don't just jump on the first big idea because it sounds good to you. At any given time, Intel will typically be testing around 50 ideas, all at different stages of development, and of these we'd only expect one to see the light of day. We have six different stages in our innovation process, and we'll actually up our level of investment at each stage. Our motto is fail early and cheaply before we put significant risk into the business. So, of course, we all know that the best form of defense is attack. So the best way to protect your company from being disrupted out of the market is to be the disruptors. As we get ready to pilot our first major innovation since the TAL innovation team was formed, I can attest to the fact that breaking the process rules, challenging risk practices, and busting through the entrenched myths that our industry has kind of really grown up on can feel really uncomfortable for the people in the company who've learned through bitter experience that things need to be done just so. So if you are the ones doing the disrupting, it's really important to manage your company through that disruption. And again, we've got a few tips for doing that. Firstly, ambiguity will reign. There's no two ways about it. Disruption feels uncomfortable. It is ambiguous. And you really need to manage your stakeholders' expectations to get them through that. Secondly, manage enthusiasm. This one might seem counterintuitive, but you actually don't want people to be too excited about it all, so they want to jump on that first big idea. But you also don't want to kill the support, so you need to get a right balance there. And finally, protect your intellectual property. You know, make sure your company is actually rewarded for the pain of being disrupted from within. The ambiguity. The cartoon on the left-hand side probably feels scarily familiar for people that are working in disruption. I don't know if everyone can read it down the back. So I'll say, it's how you see the road ahead, a nice straight line, what it will actually be like, and what you can plan for. The planning curve on the right-hand side is actually, this is real data from the project I'm currently working on. So you might be able to see the scope doubled in the first few weeks, and has sort of jumped around ever since. In addition, we've changed the product spec 9 times, we've moved our deadline 4 times, changed the policy admin solution from a nice, reliable, automated policy admin system to administering on a spreadsheet, moved away from established processes in pricing and stamp duty approach, shunned our normal customer communication channels, challenged underwriting, fundamentally changed our front-end design several times, and on and on. In the business, our stakeholders are used to having a clear brief and completing their work to a high standard once. We are concurrently designing and building, so we're asking underwriters, legal, product managers, pricing actuaries to adopt an agile approach, to work in parallel rather than waiting for a completed product spec before they start the PDS, completed underwriting before they start pricing. It's pretty uncomfortable. But speed is important in disruption, and so is being able to pivot if something clearly isn't working. We go back to our customers constantly, and we modify our processes and design in response to their feedback. Now, we do understand that the lack of structure is really uncomfortable for some of our stakeholders, and I don't think he's in the audience, but we've pretty much broken our pricing actuary during this one. But agility and flexibility are the key to getting it right. We can't avoid the ambiguity, so it's imperative that we manage our stakeholders through it. And it really helps the conversation if your company is willing to adopt different risk practices and a different risk appetite for testing these innovations to its normal tolerance for its BAU work. So managing enthusiasm with that dose of reality. And this is actually a picture of our product and underwriting GMs literally pouring ice cold water over our chief innovation disruption officer and our innovation GM. So I hope they don't mind me sharing that. So look, it is fantastic if the board and the management and the business as a whole really buys into your ideas. But you do need to ensure that their enthusiasm doesn't push you to bypass the pilot and jump straight to a full launch, or go straight from pilot into a launch without taking the time to automate the processes and bridge all the gaps that you were willing to limp along with while you were doing the pilot. You definitely don't want to kill that enthusiasm, but make sure that the role of the pilot, as distinct from a full launch, is really well understood and that you really map out the route from pilot to launch in order to set expectations. And finally, protect your intellectual property. As I said before, at any given time, we're working on, you know, up to 50 different ideas with an expectation that just one of those will make it through. And while we do endeavour to fail quickly and fail cheaply, there is obviously a reasonable cost associated with trying to drive innovation and disruptive change. So it is important that the investment you're making in innovation gives the company a competitive advantage. And so it is imperative that we protect our intellectual property. We're actually very excited because for the first time ever at TAL, we've actually been able to lodge some patents on the work that we're doing. And a really interesting side effect of this, as well as protecting the investment that TAL has made in my colleagues and I, is that it's really generated a sense of pride for everybody in the business that's been involved in the project. The patent applications sort of reinforce their sense of being involved in something that's really quite new and special, and of creating real value for the company through the disruptive change. Thank you.
Thanks, Heather. Our next speaker is Tara Cahill. Tara is the Chief Risk Officer of Group Services for Westpac. Tara leads a team responsible for the provision of independent risk advice and controls assurance globally across the Group Services portfolio. Tara joined Westpac in 2004 following a career of over 15 years in management consulting in Europe and Australia. Prior to her role as Divisional Chief Risk Officer, Tara was the head of Group Operational Risk for the group. Thank you, Tara.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Blair. Thank you, Heather. That was a great insight into disruption. I'm going to take a slightly different approach because I'm going to talk about, from a risk perspective, some of the drivers of disruption within the banking industry and also what the role of risk is around that. But before I go into that, I guess when I was first asked to come and talk about value and resilience in a world of disruptive change, I thought, well, hang on, I've been working for 25 years in a world of disruptive change. What's different? Why is this a big thing around this? We've seen the industrial revolution, introduction of computers. When I first started working, we had the old green screens on the desk, and they introduced PCs. That was pretty disruptive. And I was talking to a group of young women at Westpac just last week, and I was saying when I did my MBA, I did it on my thesis on the internet. And they were, oh. And I said, about the internet. Oh, I thought you meant you did it on the internet. You used the internet. And I was like, no, the internet wasn't around. It's I'm that old. And they all sort of sat there and went, I was kind of thinking, well, what is it about that? And also about resilience. Again, we wrote articles on it when I was working in Holland and the UK and Australia on building resilience in organizations and how you adapt to change and how you think about the emerging threats ahead of you. And then I was sort of thinking, well, actually, in Westpac, you may have seen Brian Hartzer has coined a phrase within the organization that we're actually a 200-year-old startup. And I think that kind of exemplifies where we are in this industry of thinking about things very differently. So I'm going to talk about some of the things that are driving that and why that's the case around it. So the world and banking is changing. It sure is. I'm going to start over on the right-hand side and talk there really first of all. We know that the economic conditions have been lower growth for longer. We had the global financial crisis. I think everyone in this room is very aware of the geopolitical issues that we have and the economic conditions. We have the G20 in progress at the moment, and you can see the political sort of, tensions in some of those conversations and around the room. I'll try not to call China Tasmania, a bit of a faux pas. So I think, those things we know, they're there and we've been watching that for a while. If we then move across to the new and demanding regulatory regime, we also know that we've been seeing some really quite major fines globally in the financial services sector. And where it used to be a bit of a slap on the wrist, now organizations are being fined billions of dollars, not just thousands, not just hundreds of thousands, not millions, but billions. And that says a lot. And then not only on top of having to pay those billion-dollar fines or $17 billion fines in the case of JP Morgan, they also have to then go out there and quickly recruit hundreds of thousands of risk people, consultants, to come in and create the right culture, create the right controls. And that's also then driven this focus on conduct, culture, and reputation. And we know that APRA is very focused on culture, and we have a new APS standard or CPS standard out around risk culture. And Macquarie University have been doing a survey over risk culture. It's a big focus, risk culture, conduct, and the board are all over it. They actually have to be interviewed by APRA now, and they have to attest and write a report on the risk culture of the organization. And if you look at, into the newspapers, you don't have to look far down down the road to see that there are conduct issues still rife and still happening in organizations. So that's a really big focus, because the damage you do to your reputation is really hard to repair. So we very much think about the conduct risk. We think about our culture. We think about, do we have the right controls? We think about information security and the things that can go wrong that can impact our culture. And we really can't ensure our reputation. We can have insurance around things like information security, cyber security. But if you look at Target, if you look at Home Depots, again, if you look at JP Morgan, you don't have to look far in the media again to see that those are in there every week. We see information security type of impacts that are really driving a major impact to the not just the financial results, but the reputation of these organizations. So then let's move across to the left, the more interesting part of it. And this is the bit where we start to see a differentiation between now and when we introduce PCs at work or telecoms and those types of disruptions. And we see the speed of disruption is huge. We know the speed of change, and Heather talked about being agile and being fast to react. We no longer have customers who are happy to sit back and wait for products to come to them. They actually are now the owners. They are driving the products. They're driving the thinking. They're driving the strategy of organizations. And when we see new technologies such as smartphones, such as all these devices, so in Morgan Stanley have predicted that by 2020, that's not long away from now, there'll be 75 billion devices in the world. That's 9 for every human being on the planet. That's a lot. I actually counted out how many devices I have. I sat down with my kids and went, how many devices have I got? And we went through them. I've got 6 devices, 6 interconnected devices. I carry around 2 iPhones, one for my work and one for my personal. Then I've got my iPad, I've got a home iPad, I've got a work iPad. I've got my home Mac, I've got a home computer, I've got my laptop at work. And all of these are interconnected. And the amount of data that we're creating out of that interconnected world is just unbelievable. We're creating 50% more data every year, cumulative. So I think there's something like 500 million photos are shared online every day. There's a lot of data out there. So with that, the technology advances, we're also seeing new threats to the market, so new disruptors coming out. And Heather talked about Uber. Well, you know, we've got Society One in the Australian market, which is peer-to-peer lending. We're seeing organizations such as TransferWise that do the foreign exchange. So we're seeing these new startups across every element of the traditional banking services and products. And that kind of makes you have to step back and go, well, where's that going? Because whilst they might be coming in small now and eating small parts of the market, they grow and they'll be bigger. But on the flip side of that, Gartner at a symposium in the Gold Coast last week actually said that they predict that 75% of the startups today in non-banking doing financial products will actually be out of business or will have been bought out by 2016. So, you know, you're getting that fast startups. But there are some barriers to entry. And there are barriers such as information security, stability of their platforms. The elements that we focus on from a risk perspective within banking, you know, trust is absolutely central to our customer proposition. And trust is about the security and the safety of people's money and their information. And we've seen with Apple having their photos hacked and being out there, that it happens to the biggest, best technology organizations. So we have to be ever vigilant around how we manage information security. So technology is also becoming an extension of the customer. And on the customer side of it, we're really seeing customer behaviors have changed significantly. It's banking anytime, anywhere. Hands up if you've been into a branch in the last week. Last month, couple of hands up. Last 6 months, some more hands up. The last year. Okay, I can say I haven't been into a branch in any of that time. There's one on level 7 of our building. I do all my banking on my phone. I wake up in the morning, I go, oh, God, I haven't paid so-and-so. Quickly, online banking. Our behaviours have changed significantly. And if you think about it, when we go in, I go into Woolies and I want to do my own checkout. Like, I'm going to be my checkout girl. And I, you know, maybe it's that kind of childhood thing of the ching, ching, ching going through. And when I go and book in for a flight, I want to go and do my own check-in. But your check-ins, your check-outs, your banking online, you want to do it because I'm kind of, I can do it faster. I can do it quicker. I can do it how I want to do it. So people want to be in control and they want to drive that. But they also do want omni-channels. So that drive towards having more and more online banking, people do actually still want the choice. And they do still want to be able to go and talk to somebody face-to-face on occasion, or to go into a branch and to be able to have a video link to go and talk to somebody and see that person with somebody they trust sitting next to them. So there is still the use of the branch channels around it. So from a Westpac perspective, I guess recognising the threat of new entrants, we absolutely do, and we don't underestimate that. And actually, we're investing in startups as well. We're working with fintechs. We're doing the innovation. We're not waiting for somebody else to disrupt. We're actually also disrupting ourselves. The threats are everywhere, but there are also great opportunities to take with that and some great strengths around it. And, you know, at Westpac, we don't think about disruption. We actually think about service revolution. And that's our strategy as an organization. And it permeates the whole organization around service disruption and what that means to our customers, what that means to our people, and what that means to our community. So moving on, I'm going to just... This is just a slide I had in there that shows that it's not just about young people. It's actually around everything. All of our customer segments are moving and increasing in their sophistication of mobile and digital take-up. And this is very much aligned to Roy Morgan's statistics. So it's across the banking sector that we can see whether you're 65 or 18 years old, the take-up on digital has increased significantly over the last few years. So from a risk perspective, I guess the key things I'd say around there is that Blair mentioned earlier around the operational risk sort of becoming far more prevalent. I'd say I was involved in Basel II and AMA for St. George Bank and for Westpac. And I used to have to struggle, you know, it was a real struggle to get people's attention and to talk about operational risk. And Kieran was there as well, and so was Blair, and I know Gavin's in here as well. And it was very much about being the poor cousin to credit risk and market risk. Well, just a couple of days ago, I was talking to one of the board members, and they were saying that whilst operational risk used to be the kind of poor cousin, it's very much up there to the sister to credit risk now. And we spend as much time talking about operational risk matters as we do talking about credit risk matters. And then there's a big gap then to market risk, liquidity risk, and others. But the thing that we have to do here is we have to drive from value protection, which is the traditional of everybody saying to risk, well, you know, can I do that? No, you can't, because this could go wrong, to the value creation of, well, what must go right? And they are both important. It's not an and. That you have to think about on the resilience side what can go wrong, because we really need to be making sure that we're thinking about our information security, our system stability, our processing, all of those different elements, and how can we use digital within all of those elements, as well as the value creation of, well, where do we need to go to and what are the strategic drivers and how do we achieve that? So the role has very much changed. And the bottom line, moving quickly and safely, is my team works a lot across the change portfolios within the organization. So we have over $1 billion worth of projects and change happening every year. And my team advises the Enterprise Portfolio Management Office on how we can become far more agile. And it's about taking away the barriers. It's about saying, well, whilst you used to have all of these controls and go through all of these things, now why are you doing that? the non-negotiables are these things, and this is what will make the delivery and the delivered risk work and make it sustainable into the future. So focus on those and don't do those. So I know businesses going off and doing innovation and creating garages and agile and hives and, you know, it's all the buzzwords around the organizations at the moment. But you've really got to, the role of risk is to help work out what needs to go right and how can you make this happen quicker to get to a good result. So I'm going to hand over to Kieran and look forward to your questions after.
Thank you, Tara. So just to introduce Kieran, Kieran is the Chief Risk Officer of Kuskal, where he is responsible for all risk management functions and enhancing Kuskal's risk management culture and capability across the business. He's the appointed director of the board of CUFSS Limited. And he is Kieran has more than 25 years' experience in financial services and risk management. Prior to joining Kuskal, Kieran was general manager of business risk for the retail division of the Commonwealth Bank. He also held general management roles in risk at Westpac and St George and the Australian Securities Exchange. Kieran has worked on various government advisory boards, including ComCover. Thanks, Kieran.
Thanks, Blair. Thanks, Heather and Tara. I've got three slides to talk to you about, and I think I've got about 10 minutes to do that. Just picking up on some of the themes that we've picked on, I guess I want to talk to you about what to expect from the risk team. Many in this room, it's good to talk to an audience that sort of understands the word risk. Many are deep into it. Sometimes you touch it as a project manager or whatever, but in and amongst you, you're dealing with it every day. So a couple of things I want to talk to you about, and I want to sort of go through the routine of risk and then talk to you about the disruptive element and some ideas and techniques that I think you can take back to your desk. Risk, sort of I paint the picture of a day. In the morning you're doing the normal risk thing, like whether it's credit or op risk or whatever else, you're sort of running at a certain clock pace. And then in the afternoon you change. You sort of become agile. Go and have lunch, superfood, whatever you do, and you come back and you're into agile sessions. The fundamentals you do in the morning don't change. You've just got to apply them to a different environment in the afternoon. And the way I'd sort of analyse that is it's like a hospital. If I'm a doctor and somebody's wandered into emergency, I've got to work quick. If it's a longer-term patient, I can take my time, I can do my research, etc. We actually all have days where you do both. And getting the nuances between the two is quite important. Because at the end of the day, if you don't, as a risk practitioner, think about the value you add to the business, you're not going to get anywhere. So the struggle in many ways that credit's always had a big seat at the table because guess what? I've got capital, I've got things to do, I've got clients at the end of that. And op risk has sort of been in and around that space. But I'd have to say today, if you talk to any director who's worth their weight in salt in terms of looking at the responsibilities of director, they absolutely want to make sure that the op risk is catered for. So my sort of top 10 principles, I've sort of carried these since I started in risk. Governance, appetite and strategy. So if somebody comes to me today and says, look, I'm going to disrupt, I want to change this, create this, I'm still thinking about how we operate it, what's the cost, what's our strategy and appetite around that. And those three things sort of work in parallel. If you don't get the balance right, you've got a problem. The other thing around disruptors is that whilst they create quickly, the issue that they create can also emerge quickly. And there's some work and research being done on that, which will take place. I can notice John Evans down the back in the corner there. There's some people sort of delving into spaces here around what does that really mean? You know, what if I put a dollar down here, what's the sort of risk or the pace of risk that I'm appearing in the next day? Pricing for risk. I don't think op risk has got it right yet, and we can't spend enough time. We actually need the actuaries to help us with that. So anybody in the audience, you know, make sure that the data modelling around op risk is just as agile. And I think it's going to be two tiers. It's going to be long tail and it's going to be that short-term disruption stuff. Digital, you go on forever. And I've got a slide here I'll talk to on Tara's point around digital disruption. I've got a couple of things that might scare the death out of you. Whatever happens at the end of the day, normally there's a client or a customer at the end of that exercise. And that's the view we should always take. And if we lose sight of that, we've lost sight of the adding value to the business. So I always question people that when they come to me with a great idea, you've always got to sort of add the dots back to the customer. technology and infrastructure, there's two parts. There's what are the tools you've got today, but also in that disruptive factor, are you creating a new environment? But is it different? Is it sort of the morning, the afternoon type environment? And, you know, I haven't been to a data center for 5 years, but I went to one the other day, one of the Fujitsu's latest. And seriously, what you'd fit in a room today, it would take you a football field about 5 years ago. And the pace of change, the Fujitsu manager said to me, he'll effectively get it onto this the screen in about 5 years' time. And I, of course, said, well, is the price going to change? He said, no, it'll get more expensive. So data, the cloud, all that sort of stuff is just, you know, pace, change, size will change. It's actually going to get more expensive. If you've looked at share prices of some of the major groups across the IT industry, they're probably down a bit. They're looking to pump it up. So watch out in that space. And the cloud stuff, you cannot spend enough time on it. So I'm speaking to an audience of actuaries. Data modelling and how people interact with it. So I can give you the best form data in the world, but what the interpretation is from it, what I do with it, is really what matters. So I always ask people to sort of look at those three conundrums together, and you can never spend much time on it. Tara touched on culture. Again, there's a culture in the morning and there's a culture in the afternoon. Sometimes the two meet, sometimes they run away from each other. And quite often in organisations now, you're splitting teams to be the morning and afternoon people. There will be different cultures. So I think in organisations you can look for a semblance of same culture. What you've got to look for is the parameters on the side and sort of decide whether they're healthy disruptors or they're actually off. And I've seen some businesses actually pick people up and put them in another building, reshape them and then bring them back to the hive. If there's any HR practitioners in the audience, the world is your oyster in terms of looking at culture and how that fits together. But in terms of modelling around that, can we get a quantitative assessment of culture? I think we're about 3 years away from getting that embedded. Regulation. I was at ASIC's, for my sins, I was at ASIC's Strategy Day the other day. They get about 30 of their top leaders together. And since I've left the Big Four, they said, great, you can come on down and talk to us now. Like us, they're struggling looking at the industry and saying, what does the digital age mean? What does regulation mean? I don't actually have internet technology legislation. They're looking at all that and they're saying, how do we piece that together? My pitch to them is actually the industry needs to help you with that because we actually own the game together. And there'll be, I think, I've convinced them there's some workshops that need to happen on digital age. And I think things around actuary and, in fact, Blair, I'll dob you in for that. Funny how the program here already had my name on it before Blair asked me. But as for ASIC and the regulators and RBA, with payments industry going forward, they really need our help to make sure they shape that properly. Back to clients and customers, how do you make sure your product and service is right? There's companies now, you talk about the overnight update of the app, people are doing it real time. And it's pushed, depending on your phone, like an iPhone 6, it just gets pushed to you. In fact, you look at night and say, what happened today? How are my apps updated? So people are just doing that, seeing customer experience and just pushing it out straight away. So that real time is upon us now. And again, for the quants in the room, you can never test it enough. You can never scenario analysis enough, and you can never do enough around capital and the pricing bit, which was one of my earlier points. Now, some of you, I notice there's some familiar faces in the audience. You know that I'm a devotee of Richard Watson. This guy is a futurist, and if you haven't met him, he does work for Microsoft, Apple, Google. What should the Google car do for you? He's got a couple of things that he works on, and I'll unpack one of those in a minute. But he not only predicts the death of things or the change of things, but then what will happen around it. He's got the death of credit cards. So he's got that slotted at about 2024. It's like checks. Everybody predicted the death of checks. The thing with obsolescence now is that industries will actually look to kill them because they need to move customers from X to Y. So watch out for credit cards. Near fingertip fingernails. So at the minute, if you've got a phone, you've got a tag on it or embedded within the phone is the ability for you to tap and go. People have developed watches, cufflinks, ties, suits, to do the same thing. But at the end of the day, you have to have a chip in it. And, of course, if you send your suit off to the dry cleaners with a chip in it, you know what's going to happen to the chip. But effectively, you'll be able to have fingernails. There, amongst the banking industry, they were working. Many of us are working now on smart ATMs. So my phone, if I program it properly, when I get to the ATM, I don't touch the ATM, out pops the $50. If it's the weekend, I've got the kids with me, out pops $300 because you need to. But that's happening now. You know, we've got the capability now. We've got the capability for an ATM. You know, if Blair wanders past, it'll come up with a Westpac screen. If Tara wanders past, it'll come up with CommBank. Sorry, I couldn't resist that. But effectively, the machines will talk to each other. The beauty of that is you'll be able to program what your DNA is in within that system. So back to some earlier points, you'll own how you operate in that environment. That's when we really give power to the consumer. So we all go in, you know, use our phones and slide off and slide on things. Effectively, you'll do that, and the phone will actually start thinking through how you're actually interacting with what you do every day. The Opal card could be dead in 3 years' time. The good thing is they've built the infrastructure to enable that extra environment. But if you're carrying an Opal card, you'll be able to get rid of it in 3 years' time. They're working on the app now. Interesting, somebody touched on products, how many products you got. We're up to 22 in our family. And I've reached a point of insecurity because I actually can't pass it down to my children anymore. They're going, no, I know what that model is. I don't want it anymore. So obsolescence is coming. So if anybody needs a couple of old iPads, I've got a few that I can get rid of. This is the other language. How many people look at people who can speak five languages and go, oh, my God, you're the best person in the world? All that's coming to technology. So call centres will just be able to, within I think it'll take a few years to get it right, but if Blair rings up and speaks five languages, the computer will just take care of it. If a lot of people change. In fact, it's quite interesting if you ever sat in a call centre, a lot of people who speak two languages chop and change between the language and the person on the other end of the phone saying, what's going on? The computer will take care of all that because the call centres are recording stuff and then the screen for the call centre operator will change. So all that sort of the Internet of Things, as they call it, and the way that interacts is all coming to us. Now, just for you, just for the actuaries in the room, I did dive deep into this book. Actuaries live on, but the author does predict the arrival of analytical underwear. And I actually emailed Richard and said, can you just let me know what that means? It's apparently to do with your health. It's got nothing to do with anything else. But effectively, back to, you know, I wear this sort of Fitbit thing. Effectively, it'll tell you how your kidney's going. You'll go into your doctor and plug in your underpants. It's that sort of thing. Now, for insurers that are in the world, you probably don't want to know about that data. You want to think, no, I don't want to plug that into my models. People will be looking for discounts and things like that. I think it's coming. I don't think it's that far away. And Google Glasses, similar thing. The technology will be in there. So the point of mentioning this is that when you've got disruptive things like this, does it change the way you do risk? No. Agile, yes. But really, the fundamentals stay the same. You need to know what to invest, what's the risk, what's the customer view, just how things are going to hang together. Just lastly, that book is a good one, but Richard's website, look, I've been a devotee for 20 years. He's actually shaped and influenced what I've done in sort of the business land, and I think he does a really good job. He's got a pretty free website. You can sign up for things like this. That is his map. So if you want the one document which tells you what disruption's about, it's this thing. And he analyzes it by biotech, digital tech. He's got neurotech. He's got green tech. So he's trying to tell you what's happening with your brain, what's happening with technology, where are people going. Importantly, if you're in business and if you're in insurance or actuarial space, the outcome of this is what does it mean for data? And I can't tell you, you can't do enough research around disruption to sort of, you know, it just takes 10 minutes a day. Keep up touch, talk to people and make sure you're on top of what's happening. So, and don't fall into the trap of, I'm just thinking about the disruption in my business. I mean, as all the speakers have said today, you need to think outside the square. So the less internally focused you are, probably the better job you're doing and probably the better risk management outcome. So thank you.
So how long do we have for question time? You know? We'll start with some early questions, and then we'll go into the ones that we have here. Starting with you, Heather, what specific role can actuaries play to help their companies create value through disruptive change?
Look, I think picking up quite a lot on what Kieran was saying about getting into that data and really staying ahead, I think the key thing is, as actuaries, we seem to spend an awful lot of time analysing what's gone, so having a look through the claims data, lapse data, all of that sort of past stuff in order to set our future assumptions. But I think we can really be helping out our business by looking at what might be coming. So to actually do some work, what are the levers we can pull? Let's help our business to understand if we loosen the underwriting and therefore increase our conversion rates on acquisition, what's the sweet spot where it actually still pays off for us? I know there must be something around lapse rates, you know, if we can give away a loyalty bonus to people that don't lapse again, what's the sweet spot? So really play around with the numbers that we've got at our disposal that often other areas of the business don't necessarily have the same access to, and feed that data back and really kind of proactively help people in that disruptive, innovative sort of thinking.
Thank you. Question for Tara. Australian banks and life companies face increased competitive disruption, from Heather by the looks of it. Some very real emerging risks such as cybercrime against a backdrop of limited resources and legacy systems. Are we more vulnerable than ever?
I would say there's a mixture of the two, Blair. I think yes and no. From a vulnerability part of it, some of the challenges that we're dealing with are very much around complexity of our systems. I mean, the legacy systems for a 200-year-old bank are really quite unpleasant, trust me. And we have to think about that and deal with that constantly when you can see new entrants coming in who have a clean slate. And quite often we think, wow, or say, God, wouldn't it be nice to have a clean slate and just be able to create what we want to create? But then on the other side of that, it brings some real opportunities. And mentioned earlier in the amount of data that's created, we have a huge amount of, as does the life sort of industry, have a huge amount of data around our customers, a lot more useful data and pertinent data than some of the big Googles and firms. They've got a lot of data, but the type of data that we've got, and if we can harness that data and think about that data and really interpret that, we can really be adding a lot of value to our customers. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I think the strength we have around having a tight regulatory environment, it's quite painful, but at the same time, it really creates some rigor and some trust, more trust for our customers. So it's probably a mixture of there's some pain, but there's a lot of opportunities, and I think that's pretty exciting.
Thank you. Question for Kieran. There's so much focus on meeting increased regulatory expectations, you spoke to those just earlier, and on further developing risk frameworks. How do you prevent risk managers from failing to effectively engage the business along the way?
So like most people, we sort of have a suite of 55 documents because we're an ADI and AFSL holder. And you need to, I think all the standards and guides say let's update them once a year. So you sort of pull them out and give them a refresh and go for it. We've sort of put that to the back. We now have one-page statements for each business unit, and we make sure that they are stretching those every month with the business, and importantly just building in their appetite at a local level. Mm-hmm. And we've back-ended that to KPIs for REM and things like that. So I think still amongst any team that's risk, you need a few technicians that you probably wouldn't let them near the front of the business. And they need to be there to make sure the engine ticks by in the background. I mean, if you're up for an APRA review or an ASIC review or whatever, if you haven't done those fundamentals, you get marked down. So you need a bit of housekeeping. But I think in terms of the front-facing, you need to make sure that they're literally just, they're in their team meetings, they're talking, risk is on the agenda, and effectively they're just sort of grabbing that one page every day and just tweaking it. And, you know, I say to people, if it's out of date in the morning, just change it. I think the other thing is to make sure that all that stuff doesn't have to go to five committees before it's approved. It's just dealt with under delegation by the business. So again, that gives you the agile, and exactly. Then the afternoon you've sort of got the structure that the regulator would expect. So you need a bit of both.
Fantastic. Another question for Heather. You talk about trying out a lot of different ideas. What practices have you actually put in place to manage the risk associated with that activity?
I think, as I talked about, our process, the fact that we're not spending too much time, effort or money until we've really tested it, that certainly helps in terms of managing the level of risk you're putting into the business early on. Having a really strong exit plan out of a pilot if it fails, and having that kind of articulated up front so that you're not limping along with some sort of legacy issue where you only managed to sell six policies because it was far too complicated for the world. I think that's also really important as well. But the other thing we do, when we go into a project, we really note down all of the risks. We have quite a strong risk register for the project. But because we're innovation, we're looking at that very differently, and we're going, well, if that's a risk, how can I get rid of it? How can I innovate it away? And we use that as fuel to really drive our innovation, because if it's a risk for us, it's probably a risk for everybody else. And as I think Tara said earlier, whoever solves that problem of making that risk a little bit less risky for them kind of wins the game.
Good response. Question for Tara. Could you give an example of operational risk as value creation outside of new projects? Seems like for existing projects, the op risk would be just value protection.
I think for new projects with value creation, that's quite simple. You know, you've got, if we're starting up a big program, so Bank of Melbourne, we were the first bank globally to add biometrics for logging into your online banking on your mobile. With the new Apple iPhone coming out. And so the team were very much able to get in there, and rather than doing the old, no, you can't do that, actually worked very closely with the business on, well, how can you make that work? So that's your value creation on, yeah, let's make this work. This is something new and innovative and adds value to the customer. If you're looking at existing projects, existing change, existing processes, I guess an example would be my team do a lot of controls testing across all of our operations. We've got 10,000 people in operations, about 5,000 in operations, and we run all the operations for the retail banks all across the different brands and across the institutional bank. And one of the things we talk about is the duplication and complexity. Well, value creation in my eyes is how do you find simplification and really get rid of the complexity of different brands. So when they look at St. George mortgages being processed in one way and then Westpac in another way, and they're in a perfect position to go, that doesn't make sense, let's bring that together, or on systems. So there's lots of opportunities every day for value creation and not just the value protection.
Question for Kieran. We've been speaking a lot about disruption, and as we talk about disruption, we're really thinking about emerging risks. Risk managers are so concerned about disruption that we often look for emerging risks in quite external and extreme events. In your experience, are emerging risks just as likely to be within the business, and how do we avoid such surprises?
I've always thought that, in fact, if you just pick up the paper every day, there's enough to fuel your ideas around what could be going wrong in the business. So my radar is what's happening within the industry. And I think boards are getting a lot better at saying, you know, they're fantastic for sort of saying, did you see that on the front page this morning? What space are we in on that topic?
Yeah.
They're actually golden opportunities to engage really broadly, because there's nothing like, it didn't happen to me, it happened to them, but let's make sure it doesn't. So I think that's the first radar. Like, yeah. Where do things happen that photocopied into you, what would that impact be? The second thing is just more broadly around education. Risk education to me, I mean, I think we've just got it wrong in many guises. We sort of, everybody, you know, new people join the organisation, they've got to do online training and everything else, but where's the spice in that? Mm. So again, there's got to be a bit of routine. You need everybody uniformly trained on things. But I guess, how do you add the spice? So what I always look for, what are the external events? How can you sort of say, how would they apply to us? And then build that into your training. And I think we as a risk community need to look outside of our space for educators and trainers. And, you know, some of the things we're thinking about is, you know, people like NASA, they've got this education team. And if you don't know, you can actually hire them. You know, but just something a bit different, mix it up, talk to them about analytical modelling and things like that. So that I look for that. I guess that's the disruptive factor you look for. At the end of the day, you're just trying to grab people's attention, make an impression, and get them to think the next day a bit differently. I think we try and overcook that. So, again, it's a simplicity process.
Thanks, Kieran. Another question for Tara. Given your experience in the industry, what do you think is the biggest challenge that operational risk managers face?
I think I probably touched on it earlier, I think, Blair. We've gone from having operational risk managers who were there to do all of the, you know, identify the risks and tell people what to do and fill out registers and raise issues and the sort of traditional, that's what they do. We don't have that anymore. The way I view it is that with my team, I have a very strong focus on what's our services and products that we offer as professionals. If somebody was asking us to go and, if they've asked us to go and do a review or a deep dive into something, would they pay for that in the same way they'd pay for an external to come in and do that? So we want to be able to provide value-adding advice, independent advice. We want to be able to find those opportunities for being faster and leaner and more agile. We want to take a seat at the table. We have a seat at the table in the strategic conversations where when you're sitting around the table and the COO, we're having a conversation about our online banking system, and John will say to me, well, does that work? What else can we do around that, Tara? Have you looked, you know, what else is happening in the industry? You're part of the conversation. You have a seat at the table, and you have a seat at the table early. You're not being brought in later to give a view on something. And that, I think the biggest challenge around that is the people doing operational risk, because it requires a really strong business knowledge. It requires people to be able to see around corners and look at what are the emerging risks and think differently. And it requires people to have very strong communication and stakeholder skills. So that whole trusted advisor, being independent and challenging, you've got to be well regarded to do that.
We actually had some discussion around that at lunch just earlier, that the capability set for risk managers and for actuarial teams have absolutely changed.
Yep.
Do any of you want to, I guess, have a thought of how that's changed, what you're looking for? You've touched on it now.
Yep.
Tara, maybe Heather?
I mean, look, I think the actuarial one, I think the skill set's really changed. And sometimes I feel it's a little bit mean, and I might be a bit controversial with this, that along the way, you know, once upon a time there was a rule to how you were a good actuary, and it was very numbers driven, it was very reserved, you sat on the fence, you made sure that you weren't too firm either way, that people really understood both sides of every argument, and things were really thought out. You didn't necessarily, you weren't expected to be a fantastic people leader, to run big teams, to get involved in all different areas. It was quite a narrow remit. And I think that's just grown and grown and grown. And more is being expected of the actuaries. You know, you're now expected to have some pretty strong opinions. You're expected to be in every facet of the business. You're expected to be a fantastic people leader, along with all of those traditional skills that everybody still absolutely wants. And I think that's made it really quite a challenging, difficult profession to be in. And those people that get it right, the world really is their oyster in business now. I think it's quite an amazing opportunity.
And Kieran, likewise for you, the capability changes required for risk managers, what have you seen?
Yeah, I mean, the bar's higher. I always look to have a core team and then perhaps add a bit of spice on the side. So, you know, I've hired psychologists or marketing people or, you know, a lawyer who's looking for career transition. So I think if you get a sameness amongst the team, that'll be the wrong culture. So it depends on, you know, that could be amongst a team of three. Because, you know, again, today's about disruption. You need to think about swapping people in and out and just giving them broader experience. And I think, you know, this room's a pretty experienced room. We've all sort of gone off and done a course, or we've had something in life where we said, actually, now that I've returned back to my desk, I look at things differently. I think you can do that just by getting people mixed up and just spreading them around a bit. So, and it never ends. It never ends. The new generation is coming through. I had a group the other day straight out of uni, and crikey, I mean, I thought I was in tune with their life, but in the end, I just ended up texting them to talk to them. It was just uncanny. And if they're away from their phone for 3 nanoseconds, it's hugely disruptive. So. So the first question from them was, is there any charging points in this room? My phone's about to run out. And so I just threw away what I was going to talk to them about and said, what's on your mind? And they are literally, it's just their DNA of social interaction is completely different. And I think, you know, again, we haven't sort of stared into that. I think the challenge for leaders is there's real generational things. Mm. We've got country issues, you've got all sorts of things, and you've got to throw that in and you've got to manage it. And that complexity environment, you can never spend enough time just thinking it through.
Do you have any questions on the floor? We have a mic we can carry around. Yep, we've got a question over here. We need to carry the mic down.
Just a quick question. You've all mentioned that, yes, we do have this wide-ranging renaissance person that you need now to be a chief risk officer. Are you comfortable with what is being done inside your firms and inside the profession to actually get these fully rounded people?
I'll go first on that. We're happy to do that. I think... one of the things around risk is I'm not a risk professional. I did 15 years of consulting prior to falling into risk. I enjoy risk because it gives a broad perspective and different perspectives. So I think one of the things that we're talking about within Westpac is to get really good risk people, you need to take people out of the business and take them through risk and compliance training and make sure that they really, truly understand it. And that should be part of people's career and their sort of promotions through the organisation. And tied into that, one of the things that John Arthur, who's the COO, one of my bosses, talks about is with risk, is that you need to, well, for good managers, for good leaders, they've got to have IQ, they've got to have the EQ, so the intelligence, the emotional intelligence, they've got to have TQ, which is your technology knowledge in this day and age. They've got to have RQ, which is your risk capability and knowledge, and it's got to be BQ, which is bloody quick. and I think that's right. I think that those are the sort of, that's the changing dynamic, and that's what we're looking for in driving through risk people into the future. So as Kieran said, I don't just want people who've done risk all their life. I want people who've come in from different areas. We bring people in from the business. We put our team out into the business. We do a lot of secondments and movements of people around and have a very strong community of practice across our three lines of defense. So our first line teams, risk teams, second line and the third line to make sure we're getting that diversity of thinking. And we also have a lot of people coming in and talking. So we had Kathy Amor from ASIC coming in to talk to us about ASIC and digital disruption and how they're struggling with it. We'll have different firms coming in, different industries, airline industry, telecoms, Australia Post, coming in and just bringing different perspectives and different thinking.
I think we're out of time. Just one last question was for Kieran. Seems that the plug for Richard Watson's book went down very well. Has Richard done a previous book, and how right were his predictions?
he did, actually, I think he's up to his third book. Before that, and by the way, you can email him. He's just, by the way, he doesn't sleep. It's sort of scary any time of the day. So I think he's up to his third book. Most of his work's been done around, I mean, how he's built his business is those maps that I showed you. And then working with major global corporations. So he actually didn't get time to write books because when Microsoft says to you, I want to do Windows 4, what does that mean if I release it in China versus Australia or something? I mean, that just occupies your mind. And I think we touched on IP. that IP was owned by the organisation. So he only woke up about 6 years ago and said, well, actually, why can't we just jointly own this IP and I'll write a book and I'll mention you. So, yeah, I think he's up to, this is book three, but if you ring him, if you email him, he'll send you the maps, and his maps are each year, and his accuracy rate is about 60%. And as I said, it's not only about picking the trends, but it's when it's going to happen and what's the sort of disruptive effect around it. So if I can credit cards, what else grows? What are consumers going to do with that? That's the sort of dimensional stuff that he gets into. But yeah, if you're up for an email, it'll be a series of emails, and he's quite. I actually think there's five of him sitting in London somewhere, but I haven't quite worked that out. But yeah, I've looked at others as well, but I just think in terms of accuracy, he lands the mark pretty well.
I think we'll close off there. Just remember to fill in your presenter feedback form, and also we'll just give the presenters a thank you.